Thank you, everybody. We're going to get started.
Hi. So I'm Isaac Sasson. I'm a reproductive endocrinologist with Shady Grove Fertility. Why is my alma mater? Nice to be back here. I think I had chemistry in this room in 1995. Bio in this room? It's been a long time. That's right. And after YU, I was at Yale for an MD-PhD. My PhD is in genetics. I stayed for my OB residency. I did fellowship training in fertility at Penn and joined Shady Grove Fertility about 4 years ago. And our conversation today, we're going to talk about so I was assigned the topic of secondary infertility. I'm going to roll that into advancement in reproductive medicine. I like conversations like this to be interactive. If people have questions, they should just stop and let's talk about them along the way. I'm not going to give a diagnosis today, and Rep. Rapport's not going to give a suck off, but we're more than happy to talk about topics that are on your mind. And Rep. Rapport and I are going to do this together, so periodically along the way, we'll stop and he'll address some of the halakhic questions that can arise at different steps along the way with diagnosis and treatment.
Two questions. First is, at what point after a young couple gets married, do they start to seek help with fertility issues? And second, who's the first stop? Who's the first stop of the MYN? The first stop of reproductive endocrinology?
Good. So the question was, when should a couple seek help, and who should they seek help from? And we're going to do a slide on that coming up, and we'll address some of that. It really depends on the age. So our talk today, we're going to go through infertility in a brief review, age infertility, some of the important fertility tests, particularly a hormone called AMH. We'll briefly discuss on some different treatment options, including in vitro fertilization, as well as egg freezing, and some take-home points along the way. So Shady Grove Fertility, our practice was started more than 20 years ago. We're the largest fertility practice in the country. We're a group of 36 doctors in 24 offices in 4 states. My IVF lab is just outside of Philadelphia. We do more IVF and donor egg treatment cycles than any other center in the country. We also have a number of innovative and affordable treatment options available for people, including a guarantee program where we will guarantee that couples will deliver a baby or they don't pay anything, which is a fabulous, fabulous program that couples will come to seek us out for. And so we're going to start by talking about early diagnosis and treatment. And, you know, secondary infertility means I've had a baby before and I can't get pregnant again. And so that's the that's the secondary part. And really, when physicians approach secondary infertility, the question really becomes, what has changed over time between your first pregnancy and now that has made it difficult to get pregnant? So some people may actually carry a medical diagnosis. I have a new diagnosis of thyroid disease. I have a tumor somewhere, maybe a benign tumor in the brain that may be causing it. But really, the most common, or they may have acquired a condition like endometriosis or fallopian tubes are blocked. But really, the number one most common cause of secondary infertility is age. Women have gotten older between their first pregnancy and then subsequent pregnancies. Because we all know that age is the most common cause for couples having trouble getting pregnant. Now, I do see a subset of people that tell me I had no trouble getting pregnant with my first baby, but now it's 2 years later and I'm having trouble getting pregnant. And there will be a group of those people, a group of those women, that had a lower ovarian reserve when they started trying, so they maybe had fewer eggs or compromised quality the first time they were going to get pregnant, but they were successful because they were younger. But they didn't know that they had a compromised ovarian function because they never saw an evaluation. They never needed to seek an evaluation. But now they get older, and now they're trying again for their second baby, and they show up and they find that their ovarian reserve is very, very low. And that's why they're having a hard time getting pregnant.
When you say older, what range of older are you talking about? 2 years later, 10 years later? What range?
So any range, right? Because time has changed, right? The clock has advanced. And of all the slides that I'm going to show you, this is the most important slide, right? So as women get older, graph on the bottom, the pregnancy rate goes down, the green line, and the miscarriage rate goes up dramatically. Okay? And so this is the critical window of time, right? Between 34 and 39 to try to identify women that are having trouble getting pregnant.
because that's when we can intervene to be most successful. But really, it's any period of time that intervenes.
Just to add really quickly, we spoke in the last session about how important it is to get the question right when you speak to the rabbi, when you speak to the doctor. So this is, you know, I grew up in Australia, everyone's very polite, Commonwealth country, never ask a woman her age, but when people call and they speak to us, it's one of the first questions we ask, how old are you, how old is your husband? And some people are taken aback and they go, well, why is that relevant to the question? I want to know if I need to see a doctor or not, or I want to know if Pua can tell me which doctor I need to see. But, you know, if the caller is 42 or the caller is 22, just without doing any blood work or knowing anything, and it's the first time you're speaking to them, that makes a big difference in if you're going to tell them they need to take a very aggressive approach, or maybe a less aggressive approach, and so on. So that's a huge factor.
And the reason, so this is observational data from just watching women over time, right? A large group of women, they see it gets harder for them to get pregnant as they get older.
Appreciate that at 40 years old, the risk of miscarriage in the same line is 50%. So women at 40 can get pregnant, but the likelihood of miscarriage is very, very high. Now with that said, you have to look at women in their 30s, risk of miscarriage is going to be around 20%.
So, you know, that's a high, people see that, and that's a high number, right? One in five pregnancies, or one in five women. But it's a normal part of biology. And it's a normal part of biology for two reasons. One is women are born with a set number of eggs. So unlike sperm, men make sperm all the time, right? Awake, asleep, football season, they're always making sperm. Women have a set number of eggs. Whatever you get is what you get. And a woman actually has the most number of eggs when she's a 20-week fetus. She doesn't need them when she's a 20-week fetus. She's still growing. By the time puberty comes around, she only has about 400,000 eggs left. And every month, a woman doesn't just lose one egg. She only releases one egg. But she loses like 20 eggs every month. And so, and that happens all of the time, whether she's using birth control, whether she's trying to get pregnant or not, there's always turnover. She's always losing quantity. The other challenge for an age-related infertility is quality. And so, this is fabulous data that came from a paper from RMA New Jersey in 2003, and you can see that they looked at eggs, just the egg, not the embryo. This is looking at eggs of women across the age group. And you can see that at 45 years old, the women will show up to the office at 45 saying, I'm ready to have a baby, let me do IVF with my own eggs. 95% of her eggs are abnormal at 45 years old. The overwhelming, and she has very few of them left. So this becomes a challenge for age-related infertility. But think about the 40-year-old. 40 is not unreasonable to try. The more than half of her eggs, close to 60% of her eggs, are going to be chromosomally abnormal at 40 years old. And more recently, from 2004, so this is 2014, so this also comes from RMA New Jersey, from Richard Scott's group. They biopsied, they did the PGS testing. They went to go determine which embryos were normal. And they looked at 15,000 embryos over the course of a couple of years. And they stratify them based on age group. And you can see that as women get older, the overwhelming majority of embryos, even when they go through IVF and they have that pretty embryo under the microscope, the overwhelming majority of them are chromosomally abnormal. It's very difficult to find normal embryos for women as they get older. Right, down here. So medical science doesn't know the answer to that question, but it's not surprising to see that dip. Because we looked at women that have babies born with Down syndrome. So we all talk about Down syndrome risk going. Down syndrome is extra chromosome 21. It typically reflects an abnormal egg, but can reflect an abnormal sperm. It's mostly egg. And that risk usually goes up after age 35. You start to see the slope increase. But we know that teens and women in their early 20s also have a little bit of a higher risk of Down syndrome than women in their mid-20s. And we don't know why that's the case, but data reflects the same thing.
So if the
egg, for example, might be normal, I know it's normal. No, so eggs and sperm. So the question was, if you look at an egg, can you tell if it's normal or not? And the answer is no. Eggs and sperm, if you look at that, I can't pick out the normal from the abnormal. The normal egg and the abnormal egg all look the same under the microscope. I can destroy the egg and tell you this egg that usually eats here is perfect. But then you can't use it for reproduction. Right? So there's no non-invasive way of testing egg or sperm. But once an embryo is generated, when we combine the egg and sperm, and it develops to many cells, we can test those embryos. Does that make sense?
There's a lot of territory to cover, so I'm kind of going quickly. But if people want me to stop, let's talk about any topic in depth. So this goes to your question. When does somebody seek help?
So when do we do a fertility workup? Now I want you to keep in mind that when we recommend to couples to have an evaluation, it's just a conversation. It doesn't mean that they're going for treatment. It's just sitting down with somebody and saying, can I get some more data, can I get some more information to figure out, is there something going on that may need intervention? So I don't think people should be afraid of having a conversation. It's asking for help, and physicians are usually very eager to help out couples in need. And so when should you seek help? So under 35 years old, we tell people to try for a year. And that's because 87% of couples should deliver a baby after a year of trying, when they're under 35 years old. And that's still there. Say again?
Deliver, pregnant.
Deliver. Yeah.
It's important to add also, when we talk about a couple trying for a year, so we get calls all the time. A couple will say, well, you know, we've been trying for a year. We'll say, well, what does that mean? Or when did you get married? We got married a year ago. Okay, well, actually, I was on birth control for the first 3 months. Okay, so now it's not a year. And then even a basic thing is, how often is the couple having intercourse? And are they monitoring ovulation? Do they know how to maximize the chances of pregnancy based on ovulation? So, you know, even a conversation like that earlier on is good, because then if you say, try for a year, you know, using the maximum possibility of achieving a pregnancy.
And the piece that I'll add to that is, the other end is also true. Someone has a baby, and they breastfed for 6 months to a year, and they weren't using anything to not get pregnant, right? But they were still sexually active during that period of time. And then another year goes by, and during that second year, they were trying to get pregnant. Well, really, from my perspective, they've had 2 years of trying, right? Because 1 year when they were sexually active but not trying, and another year when they were deliberately, consciously thinking about it. Trying means they're having unprotected intercourse. You're having unprotected intercourse whether your mind is trying or not, that represents opportunity for pregnancy.
Is that for both spouses, or do you are there's a difference in age? A woman's 25?
It's a woman's age.
Woman's age. And if the man's 37, if a woman's 25?
It's a woman's age that makes a difference. Yeah. Men don't see it start seeing a decline in fertility until after age 50.
Sorry, go back to the reality. A lot of times secondary infertility, sometimes people say, like, oh, I had two kids with a problem, and then I had multiple miscarriages, and I need to go on, let's say, you know, some sort of antiplatelet or some sort of clotting issue.
Yeah.
So do they always have a clotting issue, or clotting issue develop? How much is that part of secondary infertility?
Yeah, so I think it's one of the pieces, and I don't evaluate a clotting issue because of secondary infertility. The trigger to evaluate a clotting dysfunction is actually miscarriage. And that's what may trigger giving someone an anticoagulant. But there are acquired syndromes, things called antiphospholipid and antibody syndrome, which is acquired over time. The body makes antibodies that causes clots around the embryo, and that's what causes miscarriage. But that's also an acquired dysfunction.
This recommended evaluation is for secondary infertility, then?
This is for anybody, primary or secondary infertility. But if someone is 25 and has a baby, and I tell them try for a year, right? If they're unsuccessful after a year, that's the time to seek an evaluation, not treatment, seek an evaluation. Now, with that said, we're assuming health. So she's a healthy woman, and she has a period every month. So if a woman has polycystic ovarian syndrome, which can be marked by irregular menstrual cycles, well, a woman has a condition like endometriosis, marked by very painful periods, no matter what age she is, she doesn't wait for her. Because if she's not getting a regular period, she's not really going to have. And there's really no opportunity, or very little opportunity, for pregnancy. So this assumes regular, predictable menstrual cycles. You try for a year under 35. And a lot of couples will come and say, well, let me try, or they'll pick it up and go, well, don't even try for a year, let's try for another year and see what happens. So after 2 years of trying, 93% of couples will do it early. So you're only getting 6% of additional couple by trying for that second year. And that's why after a year, that's the time to seek the evaluation. And the end of that conversation may be just be trust. But at least you have an evaluation done so that there is something that needs intervention, it gets done earlier. Between 35 and 40 years old, I tell couples just try for 6 months prior to an evaluation. And after 39 to 40 years old, do 2 to 3 months, and if you haven't had a pregnancy, seek help early. Because a year later, the difference between 40 and 41, the slope is very steep. It's very hard to get pregnant as you get into your early 40s. And so at 41, don't wait a year to try. Right? Try for a couple months, but then get yourself an evaluation early on. So I think that it starts with a conversation, and at that conversation, for couples that I talk to, I outline a series of tasks for them. Now, I can't make anybody do anything, right? I'm there to give people choices. I'm there to give them my best advice. I give my wife my best advice every day. She does not take it. And so patients also may not take my best advice, but I'm there to kind of lay out what is available for them should they choose to take it. So conversations after a year under age 35. I think it's very reasonable to start with your general OBGYN. A lot of couples feel like they don't want to start there, but it's a lot of things like you want specialty care or the smartest doctor, the most specialized doctor. I don't think it really makes a difference. Whether someone's taught their OBGYN first or comes to me right away, it doesn't make a difference. But the conversation or the advice you give to people is talk to a health professional about getting evaluation.
And sometimes I see the opposite also, where couples say they don't want to see themselves as, oh my gosh, I'm going to see an RE, I need a specialist, I have a fertility problem. So rather than take that leap to a specialist, they go, well, you know, my OBGYN, I know already, and then so then they start there. But like Dr. Sasson's saying, as long as you're starting the conversation with a professional at some point, then, you know, provided it's a good doctor, which surely it is, he'll know when to refer on to a specialist if, you know, more advanced treatment or troubleshooting, as it were, is needed.
If someone had blurry vision, how long would you tell them to wait before going to the eye doctor? You wouldn't say wait a year with blurry vision. You say you have blurry vision, go talk to somebody, and they may say it's going to go away, or they may say go to an eye specialist. But you tell them to wait a year. You got to seek some type of help, and they will start to develop a plan for you.
Evaluation is really easy and straightforward. Only 4 things you need to do for an evaluation. It's a conversation about what your cycles look like. It's an HSG, an X-ray test, to evaluate whether the fallopian tubes are open. Fallopian tubes can become blocked either by sexually transmitted diseases or things like endometriosis or pelvic surgery. Someone had a cyst on the ovaries, they got operated on, the cyst was removed, that woman may have trouble getting pregnant in the future. We do a semen analysis, recommend a semen analysis for the male partner, because 40% of the time we'll find abnormalities in semen parameters, and 10% of the time is the exclusive reason why couples aren't getting pregnant. And that's true even for secondary infertility, because sperm is exquisitely sensitive to health. And so we'll find, and that can even happen in the middle of treatment. I have a guy that I've been working with now who has diabetes. We've been doing IUI on his wife for issues that she has. And all of a sudden they show up for the IUI, he doesn't have any sperm. For the first 3 times he had sperm. But there was a period of time where he was sick. His diabetes was out of control. It destroyed his sperm. But then over time, we'll be able to help him rebuild some of that. We also find a lot, I have a lot now, because there's a big push in the media, of I have low T, I have low testosterone. Men are finding I'm lethargic, I'm tired, I don't have energy. I go to my doctor, he's run the testosterone, he says you have low T, right? The pharmacy, drug companies want you to prescribe their new drug. Their family doctor gives them testosterone, they feel great, all of their sperm goes away. And so all of a sudden, right, they had sperm before, they got pregnant the first time, now they have a kid and they're exhausted. Their doctor gave them testosterone, he also made them infertile. That's also reversible, but needs a semen analysis to make that value.
So semen analysis is a little I wouldn't say controversial, but it's a, you know, it's an area of halakha that there's not really a consensus. There are obviously there, you know, there's some concerns as to how it should be done. There are opinions that suggest waiting and doing first troubleshooting on the female factor first and trying to avoid it. Ultimately, we don't suggest that that's a good idea. As far as the methods through which the semen, the sperm sample can be produced, so there's sort of a hierarchy in halakha that we advise towards based on what we believe is consensus of most poskim. So for an initial test where you're not doing an IUI, not doing any actual treatment, just a basic test, we call this a cup test, and that's where a couple would just have regular intercourse and afterwards use a sterile cup from the clinic and just collect any semen afterwards, seal the cup, take it to the clinic within half an hour and give it to them, and don't suggest telling the clinic what you're doing.
I agree with that part. Don't tell the clinic what you're doing.
They're not going to appreciate that. They're going to tell you it's no good. Facts on the ground, for most things it's okay for an initial test. It is not okay to try and do an IUI. And there are poskim or rabbis who try to say this is the only method to produce a sample, and we don't agree with that. We think that's a poor advice, and you're impairing a couple's ability to conceive by doing that. But certainly for an initial test, that's got the least halakhic barriers. Beyond that, then there's using a medical condom, medical grade condom, with a small perforation. The condom is different from what can be bought in drugstores. Don't just go to the drugstore because it always has spermicide. So the clinic will have them. Pua has them as well available. And then again, the couple would have intercourse. It's a little more sterile and more, you know, you're able to collect a better volume that way. And just take the condom again, place it in the cup, take it to the clinic, and so on. And it gets to a situation where none of that's possible. Then it's a real case-by-case situation where sometimes, you know, rabbis would give a heter for the husband to produce manually a sample, but that's, you know, many people are very against that halakhically and so on, so we try to avoid that, and case by case where it's necessary and where there's either medical reasons or halakhic reasons, you know, that create a situation where that's important, so then it's discussed.
The other scenario that I've come across, and I'm not, you will speak about its halachic permissibility,
right,
is couples will defer a semen analysis at the initial evaluation, but may proceed with treatment. And then they produce a specimen during the treatment for an IUI, and that sperm will be used for reproduction, but an analysis can also be done on that sperm.
Right, so that, you know, that's an approach as well, that people want to wait only until it's being used for actual reproduction, so in an IUI situation, and then also do the analysis. You know, it's a slightly stricter approach. There are some people who are concerned with discarding any leftover sperm that wasn't used in the process. So there's all kinds of, you know, and at Pua we don't have like one rule fits all. We try to, you know, we have people calling from, you know, lack of better terms, from the very ultra-Orthodox community to the very moderately Orthodox community, from Sfaradim, Ashkenazim, and so on and so forth. So we try to help guide people to a path that's going to be applicable to them in the best way possible, in the, you know, in the way we can help them as best possible.
If you're doing a semen analysis on the IUI specimen, are you doing a full panel, like a full testing, or will you have enough sample?
Yes, we'll have enough sample to do the full testing, but the physician has to tell the laboratory to do the full testing. Because on a typical IUI, let's see, do I have that slide? Let's see. Typically on a semen analysis, we look at four different parameters. We look at the volume, the concentration, the motility, and the morphology. And so on an IUI, a specimen used for intrauterine insemination, we'll talk a little bit about what that means in a few minutes, we typically only get the first three parameters, not the morphology parameter. So the physician just needs to ask his laboratory.
Out of all of the testing that we do for couples, the ovarian reserve testing is actually the most important testing that we do for people. And because this will affect diagnosis and prognosis. And so there is no one good test for ovarian reserve testing,
In our practice, we use three different pieces. It's a blood test on the third day of the menstrual cycle, where we check the FSH hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, the estradiol, and we also do an ultrasound to count the number of follicles, or egg sacs, that are available in a given month. If I had to pick the one test that's most important, it's actually the day three ultrasound. At that time, we also do a third blood test called AMH, anti-Mullerian hormone, and every reproductive endocrinologist should be ordering this for their patients. This is a great marker of ovarian reserve, and it projects a little bit into the future. AMH is the hormone that restrains the eggs for the future, so a woman has all of her eggs. They all want to get to the starting line. They all want to be the one that gets released. AMH is what restrains the eggs for the future. So you have eggs available for January, February, March, and years to come. The more eggs you have, the more AMH you have. We like to see, I love when patients come with an AMH between 2 and 3. Women with PCOS have a lot of eggs. They're going to come back with AMHs that are higher. It's good to have a high AMH. It's a good problem to have. It's like, some people like to make too much money in the bank, right? You all want to have that problem. So it's a good problem to have an AMH greater than 3. I'm concerned at any age, even when you're under 35, an AMH between 1 and 2 is borderline. If you're under 35 and you have an AMH of less than 1, you shouldn't be waiting a year. And one of the reasons that I think about that is you may get pregnant at 25 with an AMH of 0.5, but when you come back and see me at 28 years old, it's going to be a lot harder to get pregnant. So it's being proactive with how do we build your whole family.
Do AMH really,
change your AMH value. So birth control is not protective against losing eggs. So even when a woman, birth control works because it prevents you from releasing your eggs. The woman will still grow follicle on birth control, but they don't release that egg. But even when on birth control, those eggs are still churning over. She still loses her 20 eggs every month, even when she's taking her birth control. They're just dying. They dissolve, they go back to their proteins, their amino acids, their sugars, they disappear. So birth control is not protective. Women on birth control don't have menopause later because it preserves their eggs. But birth control will artificially lower your AMH value. So if a woman comes to the office and she says, I've been on birth control for a year, draw my AMH, I'm going to get back a low number. And I'm going to tell her she's in trouble. But she's not in trouble. I just did her AMH value while she was on birth control. She should stop her birth control for 6 to 8 weeks before getting her AMH tested.
Okay.
Pregnancy, so the reports say that you can draw an AMH level in pregnancy, but I don't think it's done enough, and there hasn't been enough outcome data. Independent of her prior pregnancy. I think you're asking, can we draw an AMH level in pregnancy?
No, I'm just
wondering,
has it affected overall ovarian reserve?
Age is what's going to affect overall ovarian reserve, not her pregnancy.
Let's keep going. What time will we finish?
10 more minutes.
We have 10 more minutes. Good. So we're going to touch on two different types of treatments. So I want to keep in mind that fertility treatment, so once you've had your conversation, you have an evaluation, your doctor will make some recommendations. I encourage women, if they're working with Puha or Puha or their rabbi, to go back to Puha or their rabbi with the physician's recommendations for, you know, halakhic validation, that those recommendations are reasonable and within, you know, the halakhic framework. Fertility treatment does not start with IVF per se. And so there's lots of other treatment options that are available. We call these low-tech treatment options. And they're composed of two different types, either ovulation induction. So this is a woman that has maybe PCOS. She does not release an egg every month. The goal for her is to get her to release one egg every month. And medications that do that are things like Clomid or Letrozole or FSH. There are women that have normal menstrual cycles. They tell me, I get a period every month, every 28 days, and it's been a year and I still can't get pregnant. That woman doesn't need to get one egg released. The body's already doing that.
try to get two or three eggs to be released. Clomid and FSH do that very well, and that's a treatment modality. It's still the same pill, the same ultrasound, the same blood test, but the goals are a little bit different, two or three eggs to be released.
Can you speak about Clomid a little bit?
So Clomid is a pill women take in our practice. It's taken from, we recommend taking it days 3 through 7 of the menstrual cycle. Textbooks traditionally talk about taking it days 5 through 9. If you have PCOS, it doesn't make a difference. If you have an unexplained infertility, you should take it 3 through 7. Its category of medication is called a SERM, a selective estrogen receptor modulator. It works on the brain. Every month, at the beginning of the cycle, when the woman has her period, those follicles, those egg sacs are small. The brain makes FSH to get one of them to grow. What Clomid does is it tricks your brain to make more FSH, and that FSH will rescue some of the other eggs from dying. So Clomid doesn't work on the ovaries, it works on the brain, so that your own FSH is increased to rescue the eggs from dying.
Will grow
and can be released, and then get fertile.
Prompts more possibilities for pregnancy, but at the same time.
Correct.
But if it's an ineffective cycle, for whatever reason, it doesn't save any more eggs. Whatever eggs are there.
Right, correct. So if a woman has 20 eggs that are available, so if every month, it's like every year, if a woman has a regular cycle, she would be sentenced to 12 periods a year. She only has 12 chances to get pregnant. How do I get someone more chances without giving them more periods? I get more than one egg to be released. And that's the principle.
What's your protocol in the practice? For how long would you treat with Clomid?
So I typically recommend treating with Clomid for 3, maybe 6 months. I want to see if there's a marker that's here. And the reason that I recommend that is because let's say your best prognosis patient, so she's 33 years old with unexplained infertility. And she's been trying for a year. So 33 years old, she should have around an 18% chance of success. And but now she's tried for a year, her success rate goes down to 2 to 3%. So how do I bring her back up? Right? So I can give her Clomid. And for that woman, I would tell her Clomid gives her a 15% chance of success. Okay? So 100 women come to my office, and they're going to take a treatment that has a 15% chance of success. Those are the 15 people that get pregnant that month. So does Clomid work? Yes, better than 2 to 3%, but I bet against her every single month. 85 is bigger than 15. Right? So although she won't get pregnant for the first time she uses Clomid. But over time, I'm going to lose that bet. Because next month she comes back, it's still a 15% chance of pregnancy, but it's 15% of 85. So these people are pregnant. They don't come back to my office. They don't take their phone again. So next month, 10 people get pregnant. The month after that, 8 people get pregnant. So by 3 months of trying, 33% of people have delivered a baby. Where you fall in the pie? I don't know. There's no you're in the pie. All right, so when to move on is based on how a woman or how a couple values her time and her emotional well-being. If she's been trying for a year and she's tired of hearing negative results and can't tolerate that anymore, she needs a different pot. Right? But at some point you have a diminishing return. Right? Because next month only 6 people are getting pregnant. So if you want to give medicine to 57 people, just to get 6 people pregnant, the other 61 people are going to be very upset. So after 6 months of trying at this success rate, 50% of people should have delivered a baby. Where anybody falls, I don't know. So how long do I give it? So I have a conversation with a couple that I'm sitting in front of. I talk about what their goals are and how they're feeling. After 6, most people, if it's going to work, will get pregnant for the first 3 months. By 6 months, you need a different treatment modality. So it's what Einstein calls it. Like the definition of insanity.
Doing the same
thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Can I answer that?
Can you top Einstein?
Can't really top Einstein. Just because...
Yeah. Is there a lifetime limit of how many spermatozoa cycles
a
woman should do?
I think that you always talk about the risks and benefits. The data says that after 6 cycles, those 6 consecutive cycles when they published that data, there was an increased risk of abnormal cells developing. So they did 5 cycles of Clomid in your, at 25, does that mean you only have 1 cycle left for your life? No.
What about the risk of
ovarian
cancer?
So the risk of ovarian cancer is related to ovulation and like the independence of fall.
Right, you are producing a little bit more ovulation.
You are. But, so no one knows that data. They've been looked at
I just want to point out really briefly, because we're coming to the end of the session, that secondary infertility in the Jewish community is, you know, it's sort of a whole sub-theme all by itself. And, you know, there's all kinds of organizations that exist, and they primarily focus on primary infertility to the extent that some categorically do not address secondary infertility. If you come to them and say, we have 2 kids, we have 3 kids, we want another child, can you help us? The answer is no, we're the wrong place for you. But at PUA, we're very proud that we do deal with couples on a daily basis, both with primary and secondary infertility. And so that's, you know, that's an important thing, that couples should feel that there is a place that they can turn to. And just because they have 1, 2, maybe 3 children, and you know, there's a tshuva from a Mordechai Eliyahu who allowed even an older couple who already had kids to undergo fertility treatment because they wanted to have more kids. So that's the general hashkafic sort of angle in PUA. Yeah, I mean, there are differences because a couple, you know, undergoing treatment on some level is a shaila. You know, we could say in a nutshell, a couple has no kids or few kids, it's less of a shaila to no shaila. The couple shows up and they have 7 kids and they say, we want to do egg donation, we want to do sperm donation. So then clearly you say, well, you know what, that's a really big shaila, I don't know about that. So then take it a step back, there's a couple with 5 kids and they want to do IVF. So not egg donation, not sperm donation, now it's a shaila. So it needs to be considered, but it's not out of the question, put it that way. It's just more of a question than it would be if it's a couple with no children, regardless of age also.
Need to spend a few more minutes doing some of the IVF sheets. So IVF stands for in vitro fertilization. It's a fabulously successful technology. It's not typically a starting point for people. So who needs IVF? So it's couples where they were unsuccessful using Clomid or IUI, that super ovulation treatment. If the fallopian tubes are blocked, if they carry genetic disorders, so they both couples may carry a bad gene for cystic fibrosis, or other recessive mutations, or couples with a severe male factor. There's sperm, but very little sperm, or it's not swimming very well. So those are really the indications for doing IVF.
This is the timeline for doing IVF. Typically, women will use injection medications, their naturally derived hormones, of FSH hormones, follicle-stimulating hormones. They use them for 9 to 13 days. They have it, and during that time, they're in the office for about 8 visits. Where they do an ultrasound and a blood test to monitor the response to the medication. They have a surgical procedure called an egg retrieval. A very fast, low-risk procedure where the vaginal ultrasound is used while the woman is typically asleep. A needle comes out from the end of the ultrasound and will puncture the follicles and capture the egg.
Embryos are then fertilized, and there are different ways of fertilizing eggs.
One way is called conventional insemination. So this is a picture of an egg in the upper left corner. Magnified, it's not typically that big. There's a shell around the outside, and you can see all the little black dots, there are sperm. So there's a couple hundred thousand sperm around the egg, and one of the sperm will swim in to fertilize the egg. Other ways of fertilizing eggs are things like ICSI, for intracytoplasmic sperm injection. The embryologist will pick up a normally shaped swimming sperm with that needle and inject it directly into the egg for fertilization. Keep in mind, when she goes to pick up that sperm, there's no idea whether the DNA is normal or not. They all kind of look very similar. Right? Can't tell if it's a boy or a girl. So she's picking up a normally shaped swimming sperm and injecting it into the egg.
We then grow embryos for 5 days, and we culture our embryos undisturbed. So they're in a device where you don't need to open the incubator. And let's see if we can get this to play. So this is an embryo.
The mother and father's nucleus has fused, and now the embryo is now dividing. It's a two-cell embryo, 3, 4 cells, and embryos will divide like this for 5 days. On day 3, we'll have an 8-cell embryo. And you can see here we've sped up time, so this is an 8-cell embryo that's now compacting. We do all of our transfers at the day 5 blastocyst stage, and that's where the embryo has separated itself into the parts that will be the placenta and the parts that become the baby. And you'll see that in a moment. And so this is now a blastocyst. So it's a ball of cells.
It's about 150 cells. It's filled with fluid. The outside of the ball becomes the placenta, and you can see these separate cells. And this part is called the inner cell mass. That's where stem cells come from, and this is the part that makes the baby.
And so we like growing, so lots of places will do embryo transfers on day 3. We recommend only doing embryo transfers on day 5 in culture, because many women can make day 3 embryos. An egg is like a lunchbox, so you put it in for everything the embryo needs for the first 3 days of life. A woman passed in the egg. But to go from day 3 to day 5, that embryo has to live autonomously. It's a live on its own. And so many women will make day 3 embryos, but most embryos will not make the transition from day 3 to day 5. So we think it's important to use day 5 embryo transfers for people.
Okay, so we're going to have to wrap up in a second because we're out of time. Just like to point out, to just briefly, that whole procedure with IVF, with injections, with egg retrieval, and with the day one to day five, and all. So there's a whole series of shilas that exist. There's questions of nida that could be an issue prior to procedure, during procedure, after procedure. There's the actual procedure in the lab of the 5 days from the egg retrieval to the transfer afterwards. Where it's important to have halakhic supervision, which is nothing the poor provides, and that way that it's impossible in the lab that there could ever be a human error. That doesn't mean that we suggest that at fine labs like Shady Grove there are errors happening every day, but halakha doesn't care how fine a lab is. Halakha wants to know with 1000% certainty that the yuchsin of the baby that's going to be born, the lineage, is not based on probability or, you know, and that, you know, in poor. We supervise thousands of cases around the world, and we have found, we have prevented mistakes from happening. Is it a mistake? It's not a mistake every day or every week, but it's enough mistakes to make us be concerned that the poskim who required such supervision, you know, had a legitimate concern that we're part of the solution to. So that all you need to know from this is to be aware that there are shilas and there are things going on, and should the time come, to know, you know, whom to ask and what to ask.
So I just want to close. Go ahead.
When you're speaking to your, when you're going through IVF and the person speaking to their, they say, I want you to coordinate with Tua. Shady Grove works closely with Tua.
All the time. So you guys will call up the Tua office, and I, you know, patients, so I have all my patients, Tua or not Tua, what religious observance do you have that may impact your fertility? And I find people have come and say we're Catholic, and, you know, they have a different set of rabbis and religions, right? Lots of different rules. And so, and if they come to me, I'm Jewish, and want some religion, but I'll call Fuha, you'll orchestrate, you know, with their team, so that they have a
shomer,
come to the office, and it's present when ever there are eggs, sperm, or embryos in the laboratory. So they're available all the time.
Is there ever pushback from the fertility clinic?
No. It depends on the clinic. But really, I am my patient's advocate, right? I'm very goal-oriented. And if this is what it's going to take to help her build her family, then this is one of the steps. It's just as important as any other step. Because if you can't get pregnant without some hot pregnancy, then no matter how much medicine I give you, we're not going to be good.
Have you gotten pushback from the clinic?
I mean, Baruch Hashem, we work with around 100 labs in the United States. So overall, it's, you know, but there are, you know, there are places where you have sometimes the caller calls from, you know, the proverbial out-of-town community, and their clinic's never heard of such a thing, and they get concerned, who are you, how are you going to come into the lab, you need to have this clearance and that, you know. So usually we're able to work with them, but once in a while, there, you know, there are clinics that don't want to have anybody. So the couple, if it's important to them, sometimes they'll do they'll be able to negotiate with the clinic at least to do the beginning of their treatment in their hometown, and they'll fly into Philadelphia or to New York or somewhere that will accommodate them for the supervision portion of their treatment.
So I'll tell you, that in our practice, we're very large, we're the largest fertility practice. We wonder about it, 5,000 IVF cycles.
We got a
And that laboratory was very reluctant to have hoo-ha cycles because it can disrupt flow in a very busy laboratory when you're doing so many procedures in a day. So we work with hoo-ha that they can come to our laboratory in Philadelphia, which does less volume. And we're more interested in it and can accommodate, you know, people that need that. So we'll see people that come up from D.C.,
Maryland,
Virginia, to our offices here. Thank you all very much. I'm happy to stick around if people have more conversation.
We are going sessions back-to-back, though. So next session is here to Dr. Lehman, and that's on fertility preservation and egg freezing, and then there's two other sessions around the building.
Right, and I think you still have the evaluation forms. You don't have to sign your name or anything, but we'll help you a lot more the next time. Exactly.